Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Rural America is often painted in broad brushstrokes, categorized as one kind of place, despite its diversity. From the rugged mountain landscapes of the West to the rolling hills of Appalachia in Ohio, rural Americans live in all kinds of environments, have all kinds of education levels, and live among all kinds of races. Black farmers in the South, Native Americans in the West, Latino communities in the Southwest. We're spending today deep diving into rural America with Professor Elizabeth Currid Halkett, who interviewed dozens of small-town residents across their country, weaving their stories together with public opinion polling and data in a book, The Overlooked Americans, The Resilience of Our Rural Towns and What It Means for Our Country. Professor Halkett is a professor of public policy at USC, and she joins us now. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me, Anna. It's really a pleasure.
Yeah, it feels like the right moment with 2 weeks until Election Day.
I know it. It does feel that way. It's really lovely to talk to you about these issues today.
So what drew you, as somebody who lives in Los Angeles and teaches at a university, to research and write about rural America?
It's a great question, and it's the first time that my autobiographical past has kind of filtered into my research. I was born in Parkersburg, West Virginia, and I grew up in a small town called Danville, Pennsylvania, along the Susquehanna River. And I'm actually there right now visiting my family. And so I always had an affiliation for small town America. What propelled me to write about rural America is after the 2016 election. You know, I live in Los Angeles. I have a lot of friends in New York. And the conversations were, oh my gosh, like, how did Donald Trump win the presidency? And, you know, the explanation amongst my friends in the media I was consuming was, you know, rural Americans are so angry. They just want to stick it to Democrats. This was a protest vote. As someone who visits small town America all the time, I didn't buy it for a second. The people I know and I have grown up with and have known for decades now, they're not angry. They're not sticking it to anyone. They're human beings like the rest of us. And why they voted for Donald Trump, that is not necessarily a vote. I felt like it was mischaracterized. And so I went hunting and I went and looked at data. And I then talked to people, dozens and dozens of people, and found that the story is so much more complicated. And it's actually not, for the vast majority of people, an angry story at all.
Yeah, when you look at the data of voters, long before the 2016 election, rural voters tended to be more Republican. Now, Trump won more of those than, say, Mitt Romney did in 2012. But it wasn't suddenly like rural America went from like a Democratic stronghold to Trump's command.
No, I mean, rural America has never been some sort of progressive hub. I mean, they exist, but in general. And I'm really glad you brought that up, Anna, because that I was going to actually say that is that one of the things that we have confused is that Donald Trump is the straw man, right? I mean, oh, rural America went really Republican with Donald Trump. Rural America has always been conservative, and it's become increasingly conservative. And so Donald Trump was, you know, the next electoral cycle, it becomes ever more so. So I think that's a really good observation you've made.
One of the other things I think is important to note in the context of elections is about 20% of Americans live in rural America. So here's the thing. Rural America didn't elect Donald Trump. Like, at least 30% of that is coming from urban, suburban.
Exactly. So I think, again, I think you could argue that, and I think this is the way it becomes a powerful story, meta-narrative about rural America, is that the vast majority of rural Americans tend to vote Republican, whereas it's more complicated and certainly in certain liberal hubs in cities tend to be more liberal. You had more of a proportion. But you're right. Percentage wise, rural Americans did not just power him to the White House.
Since we're an Ohio-based radio station, I do have to ask you about Senator J.D. Vance, who's now the vice president.
Coming.
He is now the vice president nominee. You mention him in your book. So I wonder, what impact do you think his narrative in Hillbilly Elegy had on the perception of rural America?
So this is an excellent question. I read J.D. Vance's book when it came out.
And same. Then I saw the movie.
So I have not seen the movie, but I should. But I read the book and I was really intrigued by it. I mean, this was one of the first truly autobiographical insights into a place that had been largely ignored. I then had two different experiences with the book, which was one teaching it to some of my graduate students who didn't like the book at all. They felt that Vance really lacked a sympathy for the structural forces that have eroded community, society, and economy in you know, rural Appalachia. And then when I talked to folks who lived in Appalachia, they corroborated that view, which was, it was really not empathetic enough. It didn't understand that it's, you know, Vance is clearly a very bright, very ambitious person who has risen far and fast, but he is the exception to the Appalachian story. And to sort of assume, well, I got myself to Yale, everyone else should too. I think for a lot of folks that felt unfair and unrealistic.
I want to talk a little bit about the data that we have on who lives in rural America before we dive into some of the super interesting narratives that you collected in your conversations. And these are some of these data questions, I think, really challenge some of the assumptions that we have. Are rural Americans more religious than their urban counterparts?
So on the surface, so it appears, right? But when you dig in to the data, and the data I used was the University of Chicago's General Social Survey, you find that across both religion and spirituality, which are two different questions, they are largely even. It is not wildly different at all, even down to how many times a person prays per day and how many times people attend church. These are not wildly different universes.
It's just, I don't know. That the part that fascinates me about that is I wonder if people in rural communities are just more explicit or more open about their faith. So like, it gets talked about more.
So one of the things that's really clear in rural America is that religion is a really big part of social and cultural capital. And what I mean by that is that it interweaves the community. People are, you know, they part of their social life, part of how they meet people is very much to do with the church. Now, that is true of in urban communities as well, particularly immigrant populations. But in urban America, you have a lot of at least overt secularism. You have, and the idea of the social capital is around a kid's school or membership to a museum.
Or so sports. So,
pardon?
Like kids' sports,
sports
teams.
Yes,
I'm in
exactly.
The thick of that right now. So yeah, I spend a lot of time with the parents of my kids' sports like teammates.
Yes, exactly. And so I think it's not that that doesn't happen in rural America. I mean, kids play soccer and
basketball.
Yeah. And that. But the church is very much an overt part of that. And just as a sidebar, I think that there is, particularly in very metropolitan coastal elite communities, there is an intellectualism that eschews public religiosity. So I think that's another part of it. But when you, and one of the things that came to mind when I was writing this book was very early on talking to most rural Americans, they really talked about the relationship with God. And in a totally unself-conscious way. And I realized when I was talking to rural Americans that even my best friends, I didn't know what their relationship to God was. I mean, I would know that they were Jewish or Muslim or Catholic or Protestant or what have you, but I didn't really know anything other than their cultural and religious affiliation. And yet here, these people who were virtually strangers were so open about that relationship. So that was a real difference.
We also want to hear from you this hour. Do you live in rural America? Were you raised? Do you live here in Columbus? What do you think the media, what do you think people who study these regions get right, get wrong, if you have a story that you'd like to share, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides@wosu.org. The other one that surprised me was the data on homeownership. Homeownership in rural America is comparable to a lot of its bigger city counterparts.
It's actually better. One of the things that's extraordinary, and this is what made me really rethink this idea of rural Americans feeling left behind, was on many metrics, which we would say exhibit quality of life, rural America as a whole was doing really well. So they have higher home ownership, comparable and sometimes lower unemployment rates, and median incomes that are not just comparable, but if you control for costs of living, are actually better than cities. And so this idea that rural Americans were so angry, and certainly from my anecdotal experience and the data, it just didn't add up.
There is a difference in education level between rural America and urban cities.
So that is one area that is importantly different, is that rural Americans are on the whole less likely to have a bachelor's degree or above. The question is the extent to which that matters. I think overall, most of us subscribe to the idea, certainly in cities, that social mobility is linked to having a college degree, then maybe getting a bachelor's degree. But in reality, there's a lot of jobs that don't require that. And that may not be the case entirely in cities, but in rural America, there are opportunities, particularly vocational and trade occupations, where people are able to thrive without a college degree.
I also think we're seeing sort of a nationwide reckoning with that idea. So, you know, I'm an elder millennial, but like I definitely had that, you know, graduating into the Great Recession, sort of questioning the value of spending 50, 60, 100 grand on a college degree.
So, you know, you literally read my mind. I mean, I think one of the things that we're really appreciating here is that just getting a bachelor's degree doesn't set you up. I mean, there's more and more data about where do you get your college degree. And there's kind of two different ways of looking. I mean, Raj Shetty from Harvard has done some great work looking at the fact that these state universities, these city universities can sometimes propel you into the top 20%. And so the question is it that you want to have your own NPR show, or you're okay with being an upwardly mobile professional? You know, so there's a many different ways to get there. So, you know, one thing, I actually interviewed Raj Shetty for my book, and he said, well, yeah, I mean, you know, and I'm paraphrasing him, I'm not quoting him directly, but it was this idea that you could get yourself to the top 20% without going to Yale. But if you wanted to work at the New York Times, work at NPR, be a Supreme Court justice, that those were jobs that tended to be given to people who had very elite educations, and that was a problem if we didn't give access to rural Americans in that respect.
I won't say where, but I will. So I am a Kent State University graduate here in the great state of Ohio. But I will say when I was applying for an internship in college at a big name place, we'll just leave it at that, I had a friend of a friend who knew somebody who worked there who said they don't take interns who aren't from the Ivy League.
Wow. Well, there you go.
So, and but I'm being vague on purpose. I want to, you know, some of the questions that you asked the people you interviewed were really fascinating. So one of the ones I love is, what does democracy mean to you? And you got such incredible answers.
I did. I got great answers, so full of hope and belief in this country. And here's the thing that was so amazing. There was nothing about their answer that you could say this person's Republican or this person's Democrat. In fact, I would be halfway through an interview. These interviews took an hour, 2 hours, sometimes more. And I wouldn't know if they were Republican or Democrat. Their answers weren't politically charged at all, even on political topics.
Yeah, there were two men. I don't know if it was they were in Michigan or rural Wisconsin, but like one was conservative, one was Democratic.
Yes.
And then you go through all their answers to these different questions and you say, okay, which one's which?
Yes, that's exactly right. And so one was a doctor, and then the other one was a public defender. And the public defender was super progressive. And the doctor had actually voted for Trump already twice. And if you looked at their answers, there was nothing different in how they responded.
What I find fascinating about that too, and I get this in my own life. So I was raised in a suburb of New York City. My husband grew up on a 100-acre farm. So totally different childhoods, but we've gotten a lot of exposure to each other. And I always get that question sometimes about what it life is like on the farm. But you found this real sense of community, even if you are ideologically different from them. And you spoke with this woman in particular, Shannon from Manchester, Kentucky, that reminded me of how I interact with a lot of my in-laws who have very different lived experiences.
Shannon is great. She's just a fantastic person. That was so there was sort of two really interesting things about her that really relate to our conversation. So the first is that I reached out to Shannon through a kind of a sinuous path of people recommending. I think this path started in Minnesota. And I found every time I talked to Shannon, I mean, Shannon and I could not be more different. As people ideologically, very different views on the world. And some of Shannon's views were actually in contrast to really what I think was what I felt was right. I mean, climate change is real. You need to get vaccinated. Marriage equality is really, really important. And so what was interesting to me was every time I would get off the phone with her, I would look forward to talking to her again. And the insight for me was people are not the sum of their politics. There is a kind of fundamental humanity that we can find if we bother to. And I know that, Shannon must have felt the same way about me because she kept answering my phone calls and my emails. And she must have thought my political views were crazy. They're so different from hers. So, I think that was really important to see that. And Shannon actually made this great observation. She actually called into a program I did with NPR 1A. And she called in and she said, the thing about our community is even if people are different from us, we still have to look them in the eye. And I think that's a thing, like when you're so distant from someone who's so different from you, you can create this huge, kind of scariness, which is not real in reality. It's an abstract fear of the other that doesn't exist if you have a meal with someone.
That's Elizabeth Currid Halkett, professor of public policy at USC and the author of The Overlooked Americans. Coming up, we're going to talk about the economics of life in rural America. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're often told rural America is a monolith of sparsely populated regions with aging farms and small towns in decline. Jobs have vanished, addiction has spread. However, the economic outlook for rural America isn't quite so dire, nor is it universal. We're talking about the resilience of rural places this hour with Elizabeth Currid Halkett, professor of public policy at USC and the author of The Overlooked Americans, The Resilience of Our Rural Towns and What It Means for Our Country. Before we dive into the economics of these communities, I want to have a clearer definition of where they begin and end, because we say rural-urban divide, but it isn't a bright line in the sand. It's really a continuum. Like the U.S. Department of Agriculture has categories from 1 to 9, and 1 through 3 are urban, 4 through 9 are rural, but it's like a shifting spectrum, I think.
Yeah, it's really tricky in terms of how you categorize. I mean, what One of my approaches was you remove what's designated as metro, you remove what's designated suburban, then you remove what is not designated at all, and then what's left is rural. And so it is, you're absolutely right, Anna. It's tricky in how you do these categorizations. I also think, and I think the really important takeaway of your observation is that rural America, to talk about rural America like, a small town in Appalachia is the same thing as a small town in New England. It's like comparing Akron, Ohio to New York City. These are not the same places. So the idea, and then they need different things from economic development to social policy, any sort of interventions. And so I think that becomes another complicated part of understanding the economy of rural America.
Yeah, I'm not military. My husband and I just joked that we moved like one, like a military family. So we've lived in a bunch of different places. And like Akron is about the same size as Reno, Nevada, where I used to live. I used to live in Boise, Idaho, Salem, Oregon. They're all wildly different places, even though they're all about like 200-ish thousand people.
Yeah. So they're different also. And I think, I mean, not just demographically are places different. Like if you think about rural America and the coastal West, it's much more demographically diverse than, say, a rural community in the Midwest. But economically, that's the case too. And I think this is something, and as a policy professor, I think very deeply about is that to talk about, interventions or economic development in rural America, I mean, somewhere like Idaho or Iowa, and particularly, the Pacific Northwest, these are rural communities that are really thriving. They have higher education levels, they have higher medium income, higher home ownership, everything that you can think of that you would want. These are not places that are in any sort of meaningful dire straits. Shift your gaze to Appalachia or the Deep South. These are places that are in real need of uplifting in myriad different ways. And so I think when we talk about rural America, it's like these places couldn't be more different from each other. There's parts of rural America have more in common with our cities and vice versa.
I want to take a call from Summer in Columbus, who grew up in a rural place but then went to Ohio State. Welcome to All Sides.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you.
So, yeah, my comment was, I had this thought when you were talking about the difference in education between some rural areas and city areas. I grew up in Shelby County, Ohio. I went to a really small county school, and I went to Ohio State because I wanted to become a high school agriculture teacher. And all I wanted to do was go to school, get that over with, and come back home. But once I got to Columbus, my worldview changed quite a bit, of being in college around a bunch of different people and perspectives. And I'm not someone who believes that everybody needs to go to college. I actually work in workforce development and education. But I just feel like I wish that other people who don't go to college, that's not the path for them, could have an experience like I did that kind of changed how I think about things and how I think about people and politics. Yeah, that's kind of my comment on that.
Thanks, Summer. I, having lived in nine different states, like I said, I moved a lot. But I look, we spent a ton of money moving from place to place, but I have learned so much about how different and how similar we are as people. And I have to agree with her a little bit. I don't know what you think, Elizabeth.
I think that's true, and I actually think that it cuts both ways. So I think that urban Americans who can live their entire lives in
Oh, I
cities and have
agree.
a perception of the world, I think this idea of like an exchange program, is a really good one, where people get a real experience that they interact with people that are different. I feel so lucky to have been born in rural America, to have grown up in rural America, to have been educated my first college degree was in Pittsburgh, then going to New York and then LA. I feel like I have a sense, and to your point, Anna, I actually think a lot of us would get along. We really create these tropes that don't align with just being humans and Americans.
Yeah, because we get it's hard to maintain a stereotype when you spend a lot of time with someone.
Yeah, that's a great line. I love that.
Yeah, I've really found so. Yeah, it's just in my own personal experience. Like, my husband grew up on a 100-acre farm, and I grew up in a suburb of New York City, and we've gotten to know each other. I learned how to ride a dirt bike. I learned how to shoot and hunt. Like, he's learned like about all different kinds of cuisine from me. Like,
Yeah.
It's been a real cultural exchange program the last 16 years.
And you know, one of the things I think is really clear too is if you talk to people, as I did, what do people care about, whether they live in a city or a small town? They care about their kids. They care about their parents. They're excited for the holidays that they celebrate. They do care about the environment, whether they have a bumper sticker like, you know, folks in Los Angeles, or whether they just have a compost pile and a vegetable garden. You know, it's all in the same space for the vast majority of Americans. I mean, here's the thing. This is where I'll get in hot water, is I'll say that. And they'll say, yeah, but what about the super right and the super left? Sure. But I'm talking about most people. Most people have some commonalities. And actually, if they just show up differently, you know, how they express those values.
And if you want to join our conversation and share your thoughts on rural America, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. I do want to talk a little bit about Appalachia because it is part of Ohio, particularly southeastern Ohio, has some of the highest poverty rates in our state, the highest rates of opioid addiction. And the Ohio Department of Development projects a fairly significant drop in population in those rural counties over the next 25 years. So there's lots of questions here in rural parts of Ohio about whether small towns will merge services, whether hospitals will be needed, school districts. We have 13 counties with no maternal services.
So this is scary. And I think this, again, goes back to the observation I made, which is that we can't talk about rural America as some giant monolith, because that's a place that needs absolutely doubling down in terms of resources and help. I interviewed folks in Appalachia, and I remember this one man, Clay, who said, you know, like, he described the process of getting fresh vegetables. It was like hours in a car through the mountains to get to a place where you could buy a fresh vegetable, and that they were eating, there was a kind of a gas station which had, you know, deep fried food that was where everyone got their dinner. And, you know, that is a huge problem. That is a problem, you know, if we think about all of the kind of preventative health measures that are so important. Like, if you're eating fried food every day because that's all that's nearby, that is you know, a burden on you, and then will ultimately become a problem for health services, because you're going to have to take care of people who don't get a healthy diet because they don't have no access.
The irony there is there's the same exact problem in inner city poverty.
Yeah.
Food deserts, we definitely talk about that in, you know, the heart of Columbus or Cleveland.
So that's right. So that, again, it's interesting, you know, the conversation, you know, when living in Los Angeles, you know, you have parts that are in, you know, terribly in economic decline and poverty. And then you have these incredibly rich communities like Beverly Hills. So there's no commonality there, but there is a commonality amongst the poor in our cities and the poor in our rural communities. And they both really need our help.
One of the things that really surprised me was during the pandemic, there was a real push in Ohio for broadband access, right? Everybody's home, you need better access to the internet. And what got me was you heard about it in the rural parts of Ohio, and you're like, yeah, that makes sense. They don't have the lines, they don't have the internet. But Cleveland has a real lack of broadband in certain parts of its poorer communities. So broadband access expansion is focused on places like Cleveland and Appalachia at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. These are, and again, I mean, I think if we become more bespoke in thinking about these issues, we're much more likely to solve them.
So let's talk about some of the rural parts of the country that are doing better. What did you find in, say, parts of the Northwest?
It's a great place to live. I mean, folks they own their homes. Their median income is as good, if not better, than cities. They have a much higher percentage of educated folks. Their inequality issues are much smaller. In general, just and their unemployment is really low. So you have communities that are rural that are really great success stories.
And that is one of the conversations that we have here. So much of development is directed towards, how do you build those success stories in these places? A lot of times they talk about data centers, warehouses, and it's a question of Which comes first, the infrastructure or the jobs?
So I looked at the data on jobs, and I found this really interesting. I mean, it really surprised me. I'm a student of economic geography and economic development, and we were always taught that, you know, at some point in the 1980s, when, you know, manufacturing left our cities, that knowledge jobs came into the cities, right? You've got these like professional services, you know, lawyers, accountants, finance folks, doctors, the whole, you know, needing a high level degree, jobs. Those were in our cities, and they powered our cities, and they left our rural communities behind. When I looked at the Bureau of Labor Statistics data, I actually found that wasn't entirely the case. There's actually a lot of spillover in rural communities in terms of the jobs that power them. And so what is very heartening is, like, when finance started to become more and more a part of the urban economy, it's a little bit delayed, but you see it become more and more part of the rural economy. Same for information jobs, which have declined everywhere in general now, but when they went up, they were rising everywhere. And technology jobs, computer jobs, all of that actually has spilled over into rural communities. Now, the next argument might be, well, maybe they're not the same jobs. Sometimes they're not the same jobs, but you know what? Sometimes they are the same jobs. And with remote work, you know, you can
all bets are off.
Do this work anywhere. Yeah, exactly.
I do want to ask, one of the tropes that you hear, from a liberal person living in a large city, is that rural Americans tend to be more racist, or perhaps it's their latent or subconscious racist views that led them to support Donald Trump. And this is one of those tropes that seems to persist amongst certain social circles. So what did you really find out when it came to issues of race and privilege?
I found out that the rural Americans I spoke to were not racist at all. There was no hint of it at all. There was one of the questions I ask is, do you believe in equality? And do you believe America is, or what is equality to you? And do you believe that America is an equal place? And none of them, I mean, all of their answers were the same, and they were along racial and economic lines, which is that people should have a chance, that they should be treated equally. And that in America, people were not treated equally. And it was often because of the color of their skin. They were so sensitive to that, and they didn't think it was okay. And actually, the statistics, again, the General Social Survey from University of Chicago, bears out a great sympathy for upward mobility and uplifting minority communities. There, in fact, the stats on aiding the Black community, on preferential hiring for Blacks, is actually higher amongst the least educated rural Americans than it is amongst the educated urban Americans. I mean, it's the opposite of what you would theoretically think if you bought into the tropes in our media.
That's Elizabeth Currid Halkett, professor of public policy at USC and the author of The Overlooked Americans. We're putting all of this in the context of the 2024 election, when All Sides continues, right here on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We often see rural and urban America as wildly different places. But as our guest has pointed out this hour, what divides us is not necessarily as much as what unites us. Still with us is Elizabeth Currid Halkett, professor of public policy at USC and the author of The Overlooked Americans. Elizabeth, we're 2 weeks out from Election Day. Oh my goodness. Maybe 3 weeks out from having a winner. Who knows how it's going to go? But, you know, when you hear politicians talk about different parts of the country, especially right now, I feel like they are talking in those extremes. You know, when Donald Trump talks about American carnage and big cities overrun by like drugs and crime and illegal alien gangs. But then you hear, you know, you've heard some. I mean, I guess Hillary Clinton comes to mind with the basket of deplorables, people who cling to their God and their guns. Like, what is it about elections that bring out the most extreme caricatures of our cities and our small towns?
Wow, that is a big question. I'm not sure I have the answer, but I will try.
But I think sometimes we hear all of that and we just assume that's how it is and we just run with that, even though that's said in the heat of the election.
Well, so this is the thing, is that the folks, I mean, I'm in Pennsylvania right now. I'm in Montour County, and it's, I see a lot of Trump signs. I don't see that many Kamala Harris signs. In LA, there's not many signs at all because everyone's going to vote for Kamala Harris. there are some signs, but there's no kind of concern there about how people are going to vote. And so what is interesting to me, though, is talking to folks in rural Pennsylvania, where I am right now, my friends, my family, people are not buying into an extreme narrative. I mean, people may vote for President Trump, and they're more likely to be honest, than vote for Kamala Harris, where I am in Pennsylvania. But I am not hearing violence, anger. What are sentiments that I'm hearing? I'm hearing, well, I just want my life to be okay. I don't really know what Kamala Harris stands for. I don't know if I believe in what the Democrats are doing right now. Now, keep in mind, I'm in a Republican county right now. So, it would be different. But my larger takeaway isn't whether a person votes Republican or Democrat, but the fact that on the ground, people are fairly reasonable, even if it feels like the person that they cast their vote for is not reasonable at all. The people themselves are reasonable. We're in a binary situation. You're either voting Republican or Democrat. So we ascribe a lot of emotion to that vote. But in reality, people are making, for them, practical decisions.
So what do you want listeners to keep in mind about the people who live, let's say, so we're in Columbus right now, so we're probably largely broadcasting to people who live in urban America. What would you want them to keep in mind as we head into this election? Like, what's a good takeaway from your book?
To not lose sight of our basic humanity. I think we have to realize that whatever the outcome is, that we all really do want the same things for our country. And we do have different views of who can get the job done. But I think it's really important to keep in mind that whatever happens, we shouldn't hate anyone. And we so lose sight of that. Now, the other thing I think that's a really important message is that if the political candidate that you wanted to win doesn't win, I think the important thing to keep in mind here is, why did people vote? So people are always so stumped about why folks in rural America voted for Donald Trump, right? You know, he doesn't, in theory, align with them. His economic policies are not as constructive for rural America as Democratic policies. This is the narrative. But in reality, My view is we lose sight of what everyone wants, which is a sense of dignity, a sense that their values are valued, that they are a part of the narrative. And I think a lot of people in rural America have felt not left behind, but left out.
Yeah, I mean, and you don't want to argue the nature of inflation or how much people can impact gas prices. But one of the things that we hear from voters, particularly as we go out into communities and look for people voting for both parties, is, you know, I'll hear people say, well, my groceries and my gas cost less under Trump. Yeah. And look, you can argue with some, like, I'm not going to debate who's in control of inflation and who pulls the levers on gas prices and what global issues create those problems. But like, that's a really logical, practical reason why someone might be voting that isn't caught up in, say, transgender rights or abortion or any of the hot button issues.
Exactly. Actually, I remember an op-ed in the New York Times by Mark Penn on this exact argument, which is that people are voting with how they're feeling about life. And if there are large global forces that are beyond any president's control, but they happen on that president's watch, they're ascribed to that person for better or for worse. So I think that's a big thing that is true. And I also really do believe that people want to feel understood. And Donald Trump, whether you believe it or not, has connected with rural communities, as have his Republican predecessors, in a way that the Democrats haven't been able to do.
I want to talk a little bit about the media landscape. So what I found fascinating, what are people in rural America consuming as far as access to media, even social media? Like, how are they getting their information?
So I didn't survey everyone specifically. I would actually get this information just by way of conversation. And it really was across the spectrum. I mean, you had folks who were reading the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, watching CNN, watching Fox News, and others who were getting the information from Facebook or YouTube because they weren't able to get cable, for example. So it actually was across the board. There was no kind of common theme.
Well, that's good to know, because like, it also, you might have a stereotype of what somebody consumes if they live in a certain place.
Totally. I mean, I would argue, and this is something I've really thought a lot about, that we need a way for everyone to get access to high quality journalism. I mean, some journalism like NPR is accessible to everyone if you have a radio. But in reality, I think to make sure people know where to access it, what to access, I think that is missing in my understanding of parts of rural America.
There's also been like a shuttering of local newspapers, particularly in rural America, much to my sadness. I think that's the hardest part is, you know, I used to work in a state house press corps before I took this job. So I was a newspaper reporter for most of my career. I worked in a state house press corps. And you look at every General Assembly, they take like a group portrait and you look at all the outlets and the number of people. And yeah, it's gotten more diverse, which is great, right? Like there's a lot more diversity in the press corps, but it's gotten smaller and smaller and smaller because the outlets have disappeared.
Right. I mean, that's the problem. It's a lack of local media, and people trust local media.
Much more so than they trust national media, 100%.
So when that goes away, where do they turn? And I think it's fine. You know, if you're getting your information from whatever major outlet, but the concern is when you're, diving into YouTube and Facebook, where there's lots of misinformation, and then people perceive that as news. And I think that can be a real problem.
We got an email from Pamela in Columbus. So she says she's a physician who makes house calls in urban, suburban, and rural Ohio. So she travels around, she makes house calls. And she says, I have found that people are very similar in terms of the things that are important to them in their daily lives. She says, however, it appears there are forces working against that show up in our politics. So she'd like to have you comment on the idea that our politics is, I think, if I'm understanding her correctly, our politics is intentionally trying to construe us as divided.
I think she's not wrong. you know, one of the things I'm going to quote a conversation between Barack Obama and the writer Marilyn Robinson. And I think it was the New York Review of Books or the London Review of Books. One of them was a podcast. And they were talking. And I remember President Obama said, you know, no one wants to hear the story of these nice people in this small community that all figured out a way to get along. You know, it's just not a news story. And it was really funny because he's right. I mean, that idea doesn't get people active about voting. Perhaps it makes people complacent. I don't know. There's clearly a strategy to get people really agitated, even if the reality is that people are able to get along despite having different political views.
I will give a quick plug for NPR National here because they're doing a project that's going to launch right around the election called Bridging the Divide, and it's all about communities managing to come together around the election. So,
oh, that's wonderful.
Very excited for that to launch. There'll be a lot of stories from local NPR stations all across the country. So if you want some happy stories around the election, it's going to be a bright spot. But I agree, you know, having worked in state houses so often, even the lawmakers themselves will complain. They're like, you know, 80% of what we pass is bipartisan, but y'all write about the 20% where we're at each other's throats.
Well, there's stats, and I'm blanking on the name of the book. I think it's called How We Divide or something. But the political scientists who wrote it, they found that it's only 20% of people who are active voters and are invested in politics. 80% of people don't want to have that conversation at Thanksgiving. They don't. They just want to have a meal with their friends and their family. And so, you know, that's a kind of, in whatever permutation, a reoccurring theme that I found in my own experience. You know, you cited this, the woman who wrote the email and this program. It's true. If you actually get down on the ground, you find that's I'm going to meet friends this evening who will have totally different political views from me. I'm not going to stop being their friends.
I don't know. Sometimes, especially, I think every time we get close to an election, it feels like it's getting worse. But one of the things I find really fascinating, and you talk about this in the book, is this cultural currency. And maybe we feel so different because where we live have different cultural currency. And we talked about it a little bit earlier when you talked about religion. I also think, you know, I have found personally that I got into shooting and hunting through my husband. It was not something I was raised with, but it was like I used to go out with him in Nevada and I learned how to shoot and I've been hunting with him. And that gives me a strange cultural currency. Like when I go out into rural like parts of Ohio and they're like, oh, you can talk guns. Cool. But it's not a cultural currency like where I live in Columbus.
So this is such a fantastic example. So I think one of the things that has happened is, you know, sociologists use the term cultural capital, which is a sort of some of your assets, like whether you went to college, what movies you like, what books you've read, so forth. And this is, you know, the currency in which we form communities, make friends, get jobs, all sorts of things. And one of the things that's really important is that everyone has cultural capital. We just have chosen in the kind of broader, you know, for to use a super wonky word, hegemony, you know, this kind of big kind of dominant elite Hollywood, you know, the big newspapers have decided that some cultural capital is more valuable than others. But that's not true. And I think if we realize that, you know, for example, you know, when I was in graduate school in New York City, I remember my advisor, my PhD advisor saying, like, you've got to read the op-ed page of the New York Times every day. Like, if you don't know what happened and you're having a conversation with someone, you're kind of out of position. So what did I start doing? Reading the op-ed page of the New York Times every day. You know what? If I bring that into rural Pennsylvania to my friends, some of them may or may not have read it. I don't know. That's not as valuable to them as, so how's your mom doing? How the kids doing? Do you want to come over to dinner? The Thanksgiving parade is on. Like, or the Halloween parade is on. Like, it's a different kind of currency, and you have to respect that. It's no less.
Yeah, it's just, it's different. And then you sometimes get it on the flip side where if you can't talk, you know, let's say hunting, fishing, hiking, camping, they're like, well, what do you do for fun?
I listen to podcasts. Oh.
We got a call from somebody who didn't want to be on air, but she worries that discussing Trump voters normalizes behavior that isn't normal. And I do hear this a lot as a journalist.
I think that is an excellent observation and a concern. What I would like to believe, and certainly what my experience has been talking to a lot of Trump voters, is that I didn't come across folks who thought what happened on January 6th was okay, and that feel that the outcome of this election, if it doesn't go the way they want it to, that they're going to do something extreme. My understanding is that it's still a very, very, very small group of people who think that kind of behavior is acceptable. It's not most of the people who vote for Trump. But I also think I understand the concern. I mean, I can't pretend I don't understand that.
Sometimes I think it's because they're the loudest. So I've covered vaccine bill legislation before. And let me tell you, you will, like, hundreds and hundreds of people show up. Now, they come from the far left and the far right. It's a weird circle crossover there. But, you know, 92, 93% of Ohioans vaccinate their children, something like that. So, but then hundreds and hundreds of people will show up for these bills. And in the state house, it looks like, oh my gosh, the state doesn't want this kind of vaccination law. But in reality, it's a very vocal minority.
That's such a great example. And I think it actually, it goes, you know, I think that the anti-vax movement is both left and right. So I think that's why you'd see that. But, you know, when we think about California, if you look, oh my gosh, Californians, people who live in Los Angeles, San Francisco, they're so lefty. They're so lefty. You could not have a conversation with them. Their politics are so extreme. I will tell you that folks who I know in Los Angeles, again, the vast majority are concerned about how, you know, the state is handling things, the crisis with the unhoused. I mean, these are real issues that people are not as extreme as you would think, most people.
That was Elizabeth Currid Halkett, professor of public policy at USC and the author of The Overlooked Americans. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it was such a pleasure, Anna. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.